Good afternoon. I call this meeting on Human Services Finance to order. Members, welcome again. We have a lot of bills and discussions to go through, but just wanted to start with the approval for the minutes. Representative Kwam, do you want to move the approval for the minutes on January 26, 2023?
I would so move, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kwam moved the approval of the minutes for January 26, 2023. Any discussion? See none. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. See none. The minutes for January 26, 2023 are now approved. The first action for this committee is to bring back House File 480 that we discussed previously. This bill will be referred to the State Gov Committee. So with that, I'd like to move that House File 480 be re-referred to the State Government Committee. Any discussion, members? See none. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? See none. The motion prevails. The bill 480 is now re-referred to the State Government Committee. So that we start with the presentation from the Office of Ombudsman for Long-Term Care. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Representative Knorr and distinguished committee members of the House Human Services Finance Committee, thank you for the invitation to present this testimony. I am Cheryl Hennen, the State Long-Term Care Ombudsman. I am here today to represent the voice of people in need of long-term care services and support in a licensed home or a home they own. I've been with the office since 2004. I started as a regional ombudsman. The Office of Ombudsman for Long-Term Care is an independent program of the Minnesota Board on Aging, 25-member board appointed by the governor. And I do have brochures that you should have received, and I'll get to what is tucked inside in a moment. The Ombudsman's Office is a community-based bedside advocacy program working to uphold resident rights under federal and state law. The primary purpose, to ensure resident rights are honored and as a first line of protection for the health and welfare of people. The Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program is the only program of the Federal Older Americans Act that must provide a regular presence to people in long-term care settings. Oftentimes, we as the ombudsman, we are the first person a resident will confide in about abuse, retaliation, and worry that their voice will not be heard. As your state long-term care ombudsman, I lead the statewide program that includes 39 paid staff and 12 certified ombudsman volunteers. Federal law mandates that every state must have an office of ombudsman for long-term care. The person receiving the services is our client. We investigate individual and systemic complaints brought by or on behalf of the person receiving services and work to resolve the problems to our client's satisfaction. Many of you may have supported the Elder Care and Vulnerable Adult Protection Act of 2019. Thank you. It did provide a budget appropriation to my office. The budget appropriation added 10 regional ombudsmen and 7 support staff. This increase improved the staff to resident ratio from 1 regional ombudsman to 4,500 beds, excuse me. Prior to this, our staff resident ratio to number of residents was 1 to 9,000. The national average is 1 to 2,000. So we're making progress. This year, I'm seeking additional funding to improve the capacity to ensure more people have access to free bedside advocacy and meet the complex demand to prevent or resolve problems. Within your brochures, you will see a map of the full state and a map of the metro. Currently, 25 regional ombudsmen serve defined geographic regions statewide, so every number on the map will tell you that's where we have a regional ombudsman. But the complaint work, might not be any surprise to you, is increasing in complexity. Staff shortages and related problems, such as discharges, evictions, lack of proper wound care, improper medical or medication administration, and long call wait times are a few examples. Complaints we have investigated rose by 16% from 2021 to 2022, and complaints about care programs rose 30%. The funding will support the addition of 17 full-time staff, including 10 regional ombudsmen. Representatives, distinguished representative, most of the money that I receive for this program, I firmly believe needs to be invested in our communities. So a large majority of the money is back into the communities through the work of my regional staff. The funding that I'm requesting will support an addition of 17 full-time staff, including 10 regional ombudsmen. This is an increase of $3.2 million for the fiscal year 2024 to 2025 biennium, and $3.5 million for fiscal year 2026 and 2027 and ongoing. This is in addition to the current funding of $6.053 million for fiscal year 24-25 biennium. Work we do in addition to complaint investigations includes consulting with families, providers, and other interested people. We do provide in-person training to resident councils and family councils. Additional staff will allow our office to expand our advocacy services to Minnesotans receiving licensed home care in their own apartments and private homes. Residents who receive long-term care services and supports are looking to me and to the legislature for solutions to address the staffing crisis and ensure that their rights, their choices, and safety are protected. Sincerely, now more than ever, people receiving long-term care services need us to hear their voices and respond. When investing in long-term care, it is critical that part of this, that is investing in the resident voice, advocacy, and our ombudsman office. Additional funding for long-term care should always include consumer protections, especially in the areas of greatest need, such as, and this is very key, we are seeing more and more of this, such as ensuring adequate mental health services and enhanced options for residents who may be having difficulty finding placement. We work with many people who are transferred to the hospital and not allowed to return to their home because their needs cannot be met. But I report success in advocating for people to return to their homes. If not for consumer protections built into law, many people would be in jeopardy of homelessness, which would already complicate a problem that we have. We are in facilities in homes daily. What we hear from staff working in long-term care settings is that the situation for long-term care residents is almost the worst, if not the worst, that they have ever seen. COVID-19 was and continues to be devastating for long-term care residents. Many direct care workers are not making a livable wage. These are people caring for our elderly, our loved ones, and vulnerable adults. Increases in funding are needed. Residents are having to cope, and that's saying it mildly, with deepening staffing crisis, compromises in care, and provider stress due to an uncertain and tenuous future. I had the pleasure of recently meeting with residential providers who provide care in smaller homes, many serving Black, Indigenous, and people of color. Staffing concerns are complicated by funding restrictions and policy challenges. Many people they serve have special circumstances, such as people with mental illness, and one of their major problems is suicidal ideation. They require an adequate number of trained, person-centered staff, yet the ability to provide quality care is at risk the longer we wait. And then there are other settings, as you all know, larger settings that are at risk as well due to the staffing crisis and need adequate funding. So I want to give you a few case examples. I just recently submitted our federal report. We need to do that annually. So the federal government is also hearing about what is going on in Minnesota. And this isn't just germane to Minnesota, but this is what we are seeing with our casework. A nursing home resident grew so frustrated with frequently waiting over 2 hours to have the call light answered, he actually installed a bullhorn with a siren in his bathroom with which to summon staff. We did advocate, and we did achieve progress with much shorter call light response times for this and many other residents. There was short-term improvement and then backsliding to longer call light response times. Residents of facilities, and this is across the board, not bathed for over a week, and basic care assistance not received. Imagine not being able to bathe for over a week. A person over 65 threatened with discharge eviction because where she was living said they can't care for her due to her bipolar disorder, a diagnosis the resident had upon being admitted. Another person over 65 was issued a termination notice by the facility due to staff having difficulty understanding and helping her manage substance use disorder. Here's a happy ending to this story. My office collaborating with legal aid, that's what this is about. We have to work together. More often, we were able to preserve her home, and she was able to seek treatment for substance use disorder, and she is happily living in her apartment in her assisted living. So that's a very good story. So in summary, residents deserve better. They deserve to be prioritized. I ask you to please help me strengthen the resident voice by providing additional financial support to our office. Most importantly, please prioritize the elderly and people in need of long-term care services and supports. In fact, I have a personal invitation for everyone here. Come on a ride along with me, and we will visit. Maybe you have, and that if you have, I really appreciate that. But join me. I do try to make it around the state at least once a year. I haven't really been able to do that this year as I lost a very special family member not that long ago. But I sincerely say, join me on a ride along. In visiting homes serving who I say are everyday heroes, these are people that are survivors of chronic illness or catastrophic health events. I'm quite certain all of us present in this room today know of someone who is or was in need of long-term care services and supports. It's time to invest in people who are vulnerable, aging, and as I'm sure you join me, deserve quality of life and quality of care. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Hannon, and the work that you do and your office for all Minnesotans. We appreciate the work you do, and thank you so much for the beginning of the year when we had a little bit of a brief conversation. I think there's more work that needs to be done. I have Rufus of Gilman. You have a question.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Ms. Hannon. So of your 15 regions, You currently have 39 staff and 12 volunteers? That's...
Yes.
Ms. Hannon.
Okay. I'm sorry. Excuse me. Chair Knorr, Representative Gilman, we do, that is correct. And of the 39 paid staff, we do have about 7 that are support staff. So that includes, we need policy leads. We have 2 supervisors, 2 deputies, and a volunteer coordinator. Our office also has an intake line, and it is our goal that when people call, they have a live person. And so we have about 3 people that serve on that intake line. So I hope to increase the number of regional ombudsmen.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. So of the 3 on the intake line, they're included in the 39?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Awesome. And then one other quick comment or question I had is when you said you wanted to have an increase, so also that the money could go back into community and staff, I believe. So what do you mean by it goes back into the community? Mm-hmm. Does it go back into other programs? Does it go back? Mm-hmm. That's what I'd like to have more information on is, does it go back into paying for more FTEs, or does it go into community programs?
Ms. Hannon.
Chair Knorr, Representative Gilman, that is an excellent question, and I thank you for asking it because it's clarification that I should have given earlier. What I mean by that is, for me, when we hire a regional ombudsman, they are assigned to a particular region. So I believe we are investing through that one FTE to be out in our out in the licensed facilities. You know, I talked to a provider at one point that had said to me, I really prefer to refer to them as homes instead of facilities. And I really liked that suggestion. So thank you for the question. When I talk about investing in communities, it's through more FTEs of regional ombudsmen. And we are working also to increase our number of volunteers.
Representative Gill.
Thank you so much. That answers my question.
Thank you.
Representative Zelesnik.
Thank you, Chair Knorr, and thank you. I've spent much of my career working with ombudsmen, so I appreciate the role you play. My concern, though, right now is the unsung heroes, which are our caregivers. So this is a huge aspect. And while I respect what you're saying, that people are waiting longer, and the items that you listed off for the complaints are there, and yet having more people tell the providers that isn't something that they don't already know. So I would support putting that money into caregiving right now, because the problem is we need more staff to deliver the care to the residents to reduce the complaints. And so when I look at, and the reason I say that is when I look at the complaints from 2020, the information I got from MDH and DHS is we had 18,535 complaints. In 2021, it was 19,099. That's a 3% increase. And yet the fines for assisted living went up 119% from 2020 to 2021, from $219,500 to $482,200. That's 119%, which means money not for staffing, from somebody coming into the facility. And every time that happens, that means the nurse is now not delivering care, passing the meds. They are helping get data. In addition, the nursing homes went from $2,239,883 in fines in 2020 to $3,135,201. That's a 40% increase. At the very time, what was happening then? COVID. So we have penalized these unsung heroes, if you want to say the truth, by the very policies we created in the state of Minnesota. So that is problematic to me. And there is no amount of surveying that's going to fix that until we acknowledge that. And so I agree, the unsung heroes are the caregivers, and I will support initiatives that put that money there. And then, you know, we have a system for ombudsman, which I've always had great respect for, but it's like the chicken or the egg. If we don't have the horse, we're not going to have the cart. And we're on the horse right now, and the horse absolutely has to have money going to staff. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I think there's more to digest, and there's more work to be done, and I think the departments will have to respond to some of the questions about the findings and everything else. Ms. Hannah, go ahead.
Thank you, Representative Chair Knorr. Representative, could you pronounce your last name for me? I don't want to damage it.
Yeah, that's okay. You can say Z, but it's Zalesnikar.
Zalesnikar. I appreciate you bringing this up. I agree with you, but I ask members to consider, it may seem that when an ombudsman is on deck, what we do is stand over people and tell them what they're doing wrong. There is no doubt that there are times when we do see things happening and we are working to investigate. But we also do work collaboratively because it's the resident's home. And so I hear what you're saying, but I also just ask people to think about, we need to work together and collaborate. So it's more about prevention. And in order to prevent, I'd rather be more proactive than reactive. We work with the providers. But I do appreciate what you're saying, because you're acknowledging that where the investments need to be are with our elderly, our vulnerable population. Thank you.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Knorr. And thank you. I say this with all due respect. I appreciate. My bigger message is the message that you're telling us is the message the providers know. And so there's levels of forms and paperwork and bureaucracy that are happening right now that is taking away the nursing home administrator, the director of nursing, the aides away from care. And they know the problem, and yet their hands are tied. Mm-hmm. And so we are not taking, the facilities are not taking admissions, because if they don't follow the care plan with who they have in the building right now, they're going to have somebody file a complaint. And we know they're going to wait longer to have a call late answer. Mm-hmm. They're waiting longer in the hospital. You're going to wait longer if you're in the ER. You're probably going to be in a hallway because the beds are full. So we're all waiting longer, but we're being penalized. Mm-hmm. And so it's a big question, and I think we have a lot of work to do. But thank you for the information. I appreciate it.
I know. Thank you.
The last question from Representative Plum, and then we'll come to the conclusion of this section.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there's a couple of parts of this. One, when were the regions drawn, and how often are they redrawn? And I'm trying to analyze, see if it's geographic area, so drive distance to cover that, or population. Because when I look at 14 and 15, I see it must be just divided west of Rochester, so Rochester's pulled in with.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you could help us understand that, and if they haven't been redrawn lately, it might be nice to understand if we could, to better balance the workload for driving and et cetera.
Ms. Hannah.
Chair Knorr, Representative Quam, I appreciate how much you are studying that map. So the factors that weigh into how those regions are configured are population density, windshield time, and, well, it would go along with population density, but number of facilities. And we are monitoring it, and there are changes made in order to try and lift some of the responsibility where needed. But you're exactly right when you're examining, for example, what is happening down in the south. Rochester is, for example, a very heavy populated area. So again, I really appreciate that you looked at that, because we are monitoring them on a regular basis. They are reconfigured carefully, because there could be some, we have some, it's not always that everybody is there on staff. We have some people that go out on medical leaves and such. So we just have to, we're very careful not to overload, but you are reading that right. If you look northern, there's a lot of windshield time and population density play into that. So I appreciate your comment, though. I really do, and your advice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, and thank you for being here today. You know, I know that I think we all share that we would like to see much more resources going into helping our facilities to get the staffing levels that they need so that staff can feel confident doing their jobs every day, that they're able to adequately mm-hmm. service their patients. My mom's a nurse, 43 years at the county. I get it. But I also want to acknowledge that the Office of the Ombudsman is often the critical link for families, for patients who have concerns. And having someone that can help them navigate the system, how it works, what it looks like, to make sure that they have that peace of mind that their loved one is getting the care that they need is really important. And I know it's very difficult to get time from an ombudsman because there's a lot of need, and we're seeing our aging population shifting. We have more folks who are using these services, and sometimes there are concerns, and families need to understand how to navigate that, who to ask, is this normal? And maybe it is, but just having the ability to have someone that's an advocate in your corner to help assist with those things is really valuable. So I just want to thank you for coming here today to speak with us and for all the work that you do.
Thank you so very much. Sincerely, thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Hannon. And I know we will be seeing a bill coming before us. So any final closing statement? Do you have any statements to close us?
I sincerely thank you, Chair Knorr, and committee members for allowing me to testify today, because I take very seriously that I represent the voice of residents, and that is to be done with respect and dignity. And so I appreciate this time today. I truly do. Thank you for what you do as well.
Thank you so much, and I look forward to taking that right along that new challenge.
Good.
So thank you.
Thank you.
With that, we have the first bill before. The next bill before us, that is House File 733. Representative Edelson, welcome to the committee. I will move that House File 733 be laid over for possible inclusion. Please introduce the bill and proceed.
Good to see you, Chair and members. I just want to start by just taking a moment to recognize that Senator Dave Durenberger was just announced to have passed, and it's a fitting moment as we talk about this to talk about his work on the ADA and just advocating for people with disabilities as well as seniors, and just proud to present this bill today. So I want to start with a few facts, and then I'm going to go to the bill, I promise. All right. So the number of Minnesotans that are turning 65 in this decade will be greater than the past four decades combined. In around 2020, we have seen our population of Minnesotans that are 65 and older are eclipsing the ages of 5 to 17. So we all know this. We know that we have populations that are aging. And I think everybody, as we come together as lawmakers, to try to work together, because I really do think this is a bipartisan issue. We all have grandparents or a loved one that is a senior. People are coming, whether it's advocates that work in our nursing homes or those that are running our nursing homes. And I think today, what I just want to present is this is a bill and a solution that's coming from the long-term care imperative. So that's looking at from leading age in the care providers and what they have or what they're proposing as being something that will help in this industry. But I just, before we go to the bill, I think we have a people problem we need more people in the state of Minnesota. So we can talk about rate increases, and I'm excited to propose this. But as lawmakers, we have to figure out how we get more Minnesotans here, or more people to Minnesota, become Minnesotans. So, all right. So House File 733 is looking, I'm just going to walk through sections of the bill so that we have it. And if testifiers want to go ahead and come up here, and then we can move to you when we're done. Okay, so Section 1 will require the commissioner to establish home-delivered meal rates for the disability waivers. Section 2 is modifying the definition of dietary costs. Section 3 is defining what a dietary labor cost is. Section 4 is modifying the definition of housekeeping cost. Section 5 is looking at housekeeping labor cost. And then Section 6 is known cost factor change. And I really want to highlight that because that's something that we're going to have a lot of testifiers talk about today, that we're seeing lots of problems in. And I know Representative Zalesnikar, right? Her name. It's a good name. But you probably also know about this as well. I think you work in the industry. Section 7 is modifying the definition of laundry cost. Section 8 is defining laundry labor cost. Section 9 is modifying a definition of maintenance implant operation cost. Section 10 is maintenance implant operations and labor cost. Very technical, riveting little pieces here. Section 11 is modifying the definition of other care-related costs. Section 12 is modifying calculation of nursing facility direct care cost per standardized day. Section 13 is modifying a calculation of nursing home and care-related costs per resident. We're going to skip forward to, let's see here. You know, the other one I just want to highlight, I think this is the other one that's really important, is Section 21, which is going to be requiring the total payment rate of nursing home facilities that they receive reimbursement rates that would increase to $52 per day per resident. And the goal of this, members, is to get that wage to be closer to about $25 an hour. And so with that, I'm going to not walk through all the other technical fixes and go straight to my testifiers, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind.
Thank you so much, Representative Edelson. Welcome to the committee. So your first step is yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patty Cullen. I'm the President and CEO of Care Providers in Minnesota. And joining me at the table today will be my colleague from Leading Age, Carrie Thurlow, who will wrap up at the end. After my testimony, Ms. Sorensen, who is a resident at one of our communities, will be speaking. And then we have a provider, Brielle, who will be doing some comments from the provider perspective. So I'm going to tee this issue up, the kind of the why, to add to some of the statistics that Representative Edelman shared with you. So first of all, I want to thank you for bringing the bill forward. It is one of the most critical issues, and I think I'm probably in this world so much, but I also look at the demographics and the numbers, and it's always a surprise to me that seniors aren't ranking top of everyone's list, just looking at the sheer demographics. Care Providers in Minnesota has a name that's often Googled, and I get calls. I get calls from family members who can't find a placement for their loved one. I get calls from seniors who are stuck in the hospitals. So we did a survey, and last fall we surveyed and found that Minnesota seniors, in 1 month, they were denied admission 11,000 times because we couldn't staff our communities in order for them to move into our communities. So they're being denied the care, and then where do they go if not the local nursing home or assisted living? I believe Representative Zalesnikar referenced the ER. They're sitting in hospitals waiting to be discharged. And we know that's the wrong place for them. You know that's the wrong place for them. Harming access for Minnesota impacts the entire healthcare system. And so starting out with that, we also know, based on the recent data from Minnesota Hospital, there were 14,622 extra hospital patient days in just 1 week because of not being unable to discharge. So having been in this profession for about 40 years, I've seen ebbs and flows. This is definitely the worst workforce shortage in the history that I've ever experienced. This bill provides some solutions in order to stabilize our workforce, to make it a profession that people want to stay in and that what they want to go into. It's critical that we do that. Couple additional statistics. So our communities, the nursing facilities and assisted living, have spent all available federal funds that they could. They've spent out all of their reserves just to try to keep the staff and to pay the increased inflationary costs that you are all familiar with. Eggs, I give that example. You know, they serve them in our facilities, and we have a rate system that doesn't account for significant increased inflationary costs. COVID is still there. They still have to buy PPE, which is very expensive. So all of these costs means they've spent all of their reserves. About 40% of nursing homes and assisted living responded in a survey. If they were going to miss one payment from the state, they couldn't cover payroll. Right? So cash flow is critical. This bill, unfortunately, is going to be too late for several nursing homes in the state. We've had 15 close their doors since 2019. We have three that have closed them in 2022 alone. But in addition, because we need to take advantage of programs we have in the state to lay away beds and close beds, there's been 2,200 nursing facility beds closed since the pandemic started. That means that's the equivalent of about 40 nursing homes. So you think about access and you think about what would happen if we have additional closures. Communities in rural Minnesota are experiencing kind of closures of their top employers, the small rural communities, because that's who we are. But families are driving hours to visit their loved ones. And that, to me, is one of the devastations for this area. We cannot forget why caregivers are called to this work and the important role they play in assuring that seniors, and we agree with the state ombudsman, that seniors need to live in a place where they have dignity and support and respect. We all have that same goal, but we need money to be able to pay our workers so that we can recruit and retain the workforce we need. So I'm very pleased that we have a resident of one of our settings here who can share her experience. So I'm going to turn the microphone over to Mary Eileen Sorensen.
Ms. Sorensen, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
You want my name, Mary Eileen Sorensen. Is that enough?
That's good enough.
That's okay. Thank you. I'm really astounded at looking at all of you because I was a teacher for 35 years, and you're paying more attention than my students ever did.
A good compliment. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm Mary Eileen Sorensen. I'm 84 years old, widowed, and living on Westwood Ridge Assisted Living Campus in West St. Paul. I'm a rather ordinary person. I'm not an expert in state budgets, reimbursement rates, or waivers. However, I am an informed citizen, and I ask you to listen, not just for information, but as you would listen to your elderly parents, grandparents, a dear friend, or a neighbor. When we move in to assisted living campuses, we and family, caregivers, and friends expect competent and loving service. This is still there from the many staff people who are extraordinary in efforts serving us. However, in October 2022, 11,000 Minnesotans were turned away because there was not enough staff available. How would you respond if that was your family member? How would you respond if a staff member whom your family member had for several years left because $15 an hour is not sufficient to provide for a family? How would you like to hear that a family member's elderly waiver is not enough to cover costs? How would you respond if rent went up $230 a month, as it has for me this year? What is your answer to providers who are doing all they can to give a living wage to staff and still falling short and operating in the red? I want to share a brief story with you. Najib is our housekeeper. When I moved in, we had three. Now we have one. The number of residents have not changed. Although I do not need housekeeping yet, there is not a day goes by that Najib doesn't greet me. I meet him in the halls, in the laundry room, even in the garage recently, while he's disposing of someone's old microwave. He never fails to say, "Hello, Mary." Even the day I was in tears about a loss of a dear friend, he stopped and listened and simply offered me a bit of his busy time. He tells me of his two children in college and high school. He sometimes talks on Friday of feeling really tired and looking forward to a restful weekend. Najib is family to me and to others. He is who takes care of me and our elderly family and your elderly family members because you are not able. He makes up for the time left after your weekly visit to Mom or Grandpa. A few weeks ago, I did not see him at all on Monday. I was surprised at how frightened I was. Was he sick? Did he leave like some of the others? Was he unhappy? The next day, I was happy. He was back to cleaning the lobby floors. I hugged him and I said, "I was so scared." He said, "No worry. I will be there for you." That's the day I knew he was family. Najib and others deserve more than $15 an hour. Would any of you work for that and give so much of your time and spirit in a job 24/7? These staff people give care that you assume will always be there for us. I am here today to insist that you begin to address the inequalities of pay. A minimum wage of $25 should be a given. And just an aside, the United Nations considers a living wage a human right. I know there are many deserving of consideration in your budgeting this year. I would just like to remind you, we do feel forgotten at times. We are your elders. We hold the stories and memories and life of our communities. We are the bearers of the light of wisdom. We need nourishment, attention, and caring. We live the cycle of life every day. Being elderly can be lonely, fearful, even isolating. At times we do feel invisible. Hope becomes fragile. Najib and the other staff people keep hope alive for us. They have a right to a living wage, not just for what they do, but who they are. They are family, not just for me, but for all of us. Please remember that when you are debating reimbursement rates and waivers. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Sorensen. Thank you for your testimony. You are not forgotten. We listen to our elders, and you asked us a huge question, how will you respond? And that's our responsibility to make sure that we respond to the challenges and the opportunity that we have today. So thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I appreciate you for coming today.
Thank you.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Brielle Kaler. I am currently serving as the executive director at Ecumen Lakeview Commons in Maplewood. I've been there for about 4 years, and we provide assisted living and memory care services to residents who are both private payers and who receive their care and services through the elderly waiver system. I'm passionate about continuing to provide high-quality care to the growing population of seniors in Minnesota. But I'm concerned that unless changes are made, many older Minnesotans will not receive the care and housing that they need. 50,000 Minnesotans are getting ready to turn 80. And there are 22,000 open caregiver positions across the state. The senior care providers of Minnesota, those who choose to do this work, are committed to ensuring that we can all age with dignity. Now we need the same commitment from you. I want to tell you a story about a woman who lives in my community. I'll call her Jane. Jane is such a gift to our community. Until this year, she was a dance teacher her whole life. She taught dance classes in our community to our seniors. She was a longtime staff member of the, Winter Carnival in St. Paul. This wonderful woman receives 3 meals a day with room service if requested, weekly housekeeping, linen service, laundry services, in-person wellness classes 3 times a week, and daily life enrichment programming for 6 to 7 hours a day, spiritual care provided by our on-staff chaplain, shopping trips and other outings in our community van, and assistance ranging transportation and accessing community resources, among other day-to-day catered living services. For these services, we receive only $26 a day reimbursed through the Elder Waiver Program. Providers in Minnesota like us receive just 20% of what it costs us to provide the high-quality care. We consider it a privilege to serve each one of our residents, but this is not sustainable. And the reality is that some providers will not be able to stay open, leaving more Minnesotans without care and the support that they need. This is Minnesota. We pride ourselves on having a top quality healthcare system. We cannot continue to make that claim if we fail to adequately provide care for this large section of our population. Do our Minnesota seniors not deserve to receive care with dignity and respect in the settings that they choose, regardless of their socioeconomic status? On behalf of my colleagues and those that we serve, I urge you to support this bill and invest in our state seniors.
Thank you, Ms. Kell. Well, to the next testifier, please welcome to the committee, introduce yourself, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the president and CEO of Leading Age Minnesota here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. And when I was driving over here today, I was trying to figure out a non-academic way to present this issue, reimbursement rates, payment rates per day, et cetera, et cetera. It's a hard conversation to have, especially when I know that you hear hundreds of bills every single day. But I really can't think of a more perfect way that we've been able to sort of present it in a non-academic way. When you hear the impact on individuals like Ms. Sorensen, or when you hear about her favorite housekeeper, or when Brielle testifies as well. Behind all of the numbers, and admittedly a very large financial investment that we're asking for Minnesota's senior caregivers in assisted living and nursing homes, it's important to remember that what we're really talking about is the quality of life for Minnesota's caregivers and their families and the seniors and families that they serve. So bearing that in mind, I'd like to take just a few minutes to, first of all, thank Representative Edelson for bringing forward this important legislation, but also share a little bit about what this bill does and how it will actually do what we hope that it will do in terms of addressing the crisis in caregiving. I, at the outset, want to acknowledge Representative Edelson is right. We have a numbers issue here in Minnesota. We don't have enough people. And we would acknowledge that there is a lot more that we need to do working together to figure out how we have the workforce to take care of our vulnerable seniors and other Minnesotans, as well as our children. But an important first step is to ensure that the jobs that we offer in caregiving careers in Minnesota's nursing homes and assisted living settings are paying a livable wage. So the first important thing that House File 733 does is provide an immediate infusion of funding in Minnesota nursing home rates by $52 a day. per resident day to allow for an immediate infusion of caregiver improving caregiver wages. Currently, the average wage for a direct senior care worker in Minnesota is just $17 per hour, as has been mentioned several times. We believe strongly that solving the caregiving crisis in order to recruit the people that we need and to retain the people we need requires increasing reimbursement rates set by this legislature to support starting wages of $25 an hour. And that's what this legislation will do. I can't underscore enough that inadequate funding for senior care negatively impacts working families. Our caregiving workforce is predominantly women, as well as one of the most diverse workforces sectors in the state. And that with chronic underfunding of senior care, it is also impacting the lives of those working Minnesotans. House File 7033 acknowledges that the majority of spending in nursing homes is directly to staff salaries and benefits, and continues to support the transparency that we started when we first reformed rates back in 2015. I know some of you were in the room when we did that. But that legislation didn't contemplate 8% inflation. It didn't contemplate a pandemic. And it requires nursing homes to have money on hand to float a 21-month delay before those wages are recognized in rates. Those nursing homes don't have that, which is why an immediate infusion of cash is necessary. It also puts in place a critical increase to the state's elderly waiver program, which is Medicaid that supports seniors that choose to receive their care outside of nursing homes in home and community-based services as well as assisted living settings. This program has not kept up and is sorely underfunded. In 2019, DHS documented that the funding for that program was woefully behind the cost of care at that time. And since then, we've had pandemics and inflation, and yet those caregivers are making far below what they could be making in other settings. So in short, we very much value your support and attention to this issue in prioritizing it in this bill. 1 in 4 Minnesotans will be the age of 65 or older by 2030, and 50,000 Minnesotans will turn 80 in the next 5 years. This is part of our future as much as it is as we talk about other aspects of the future of Minnesotans. We need to pay attention to how we will prepare and care for Minnesota's seniors. Someone turning 65 today has almost a 70% chance of needing some type of long-term care funding for services and supports in their remaining years. So it is not simple enough to just sort of ignore this and hope that you're one of the lucky ones that doesn't need formal senior care. It's more likely than not our aging population will need this critical infrastructure. And it impacts our entire healthcare system. When you hear hospitals being backed up and somebody can't find hospital care, it's possible because somebody's staying in a hospital too long because they can't find care in Minnesota's long-term care settings. So again, I'm very grateful. We are very grateful to Representative Edelson as well as her co-authors and to Chair Knorr for your support of this bill and for hearing this. I can't urge you enough to prioritize this in this legislative session. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Stella. We have two more testifiers. I have Richmond. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
You were first on the agenda. Do you want to go?
Okay. It's like musical chairs. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Shakaya Richmond, and I currently serve as a board on the Board of Directors for Residential Providers Association of Minnesota, or also known as RPAMN. I am also an owner and operator of an assisted living facility right here in St. Paul that services those both in the disabled community and elderly. RPAMN is a 501c6 nonprofit trade association that represents small residential customized living and waiver service providers in Minnesota. We were formed in 2021 following a series of massive changes in the regulatory and reimbursement landscape in which our members operate. RPAMN has roughly 200 providers, members, and subscribers, with the vast majority being BIPOC-owned, culturally competent service providers who might not otherwise engage in the policy development and legislative process. I'm here today to offer some brief testimony in support of HF733 and highlight how it positively impacts a subsegment of providers of the provider community and culturally diverse communities we seek to serve. As introduced, HF733 would offer much needed support to hundreds of customized living providers, a large percent of whom are culturally competent BIPOC-owned agencies that are currently servicing individuals on the CADI and BI waivers. As a community of providers, we have generally organized ourselves in the years since the 2009 adult foster care moratorium was implemented, and as such have been unable to operate with the conventional DWRS framework that you generally think of when you think about a four-bed adult foster care or group home setting. In fact, I don't believe it was until we were inadvertently rolled up into the 2019 assisted living licensure law that anyone knew how many providers were then using a comprehensive home care license to provide customized living in single family homes. Unfortunately, in recent years, the Minnesota Department of Human Services and others have decided that customized living is no longer a preferred setting to serve individuals on the CADI and BI waivers, and they have actively sought to reduce the number of individuals our members are able to serve. For example, in 2021, customized living settings service individuals on the CADI and BI waivers were the only disability service providers expressly excluded from the broad and essential rate increases that the legislator passed with the help of federal funds. I cannot emphasize the negative impact that the budget decision had on our members and the communities we serve. Today, providers are struggling to recruit and retain staff while navigating a complicated and broken process to transition into the DWRS system. The language in the HF733 would undo the damaging segregation of customized living rates for the EW and CADI BI and provide long overdue support for hundreds of BIPOC service providers. If funded, the bill will ensure that thousands of immigrants, refugees, and Minnesotans of color would have the option to receive culturally competent residential services from the members of their own community. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Ms. Richmond. So if you could wait until the final testifier, I believe it's Austin Delaney.
Yes.
All right, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon. And thank you to members of the committee. My name is Austin Bliley. I'm the Regional Vice President of Operations for the Upper Midwest with Mission Health Communities, based out of our New Hope, Minnesota campus. Northridge Health and Rehab is the largest skilled
nursing. Mr. Bliley, if you can move the mic closer.
Yeah. Yell louder.
You can, yeah.
Northridge Health and Rehab is the largest skilled nursing home in the state of Minnesota. But also on our campus, we have the Residence at Northridge, which is a licensed assisted living with dementia care facility. We also provide adult daycare services and child daycare services. Currently, our campus has a little over 300 employees to serve almost 350 Minnesota seniors. However, serving 350 Minnesota seniors is 68% of our max capacity. If we look back prior to the pandemic, in January of 2020, our occupancy was about 85% as a campus. This obviously has caused our revenues to be significantly impacted, decreasing about 15% over that time frame. During this time frame, our expenses increased exponentially. Required PPE, inflation of food, competitiveness of the market with the wage inflation, all these were factors why our expenses were increased. Under our current reimbursement system, a lot of these expenses will not be recognized until 2024 at the earliest. As it relates to access, during the year 2022, Northridge Health and Rehab turned away on average 115 referrals a month from our hospital partners. These main partners include North Memorial Healthcare, HCMC, Abbott Northwest, just to name a few of our hospital partners. We refuse to sacrifice our quality of care to stretch our revenues. Doing this has led to our decrease in revenues. We do have space to care for these residents, though. We just simply do not have the staff to care for these hospital patients. Currently, we have 3 units just sitting empty in our nursing home, simply because we don't have the staff to care for the residents. Right now, we have about 87 open FTE positions on our campus. This is, over the past year and a half, we have increased wages for our clinical staff, almost 16% the past 18 months. But unlike other industries that can raise prices to correspond their increased expenses to get higher revenue, we cannot. We depend on the laws and the lawmakers to increase our rates. And as a campus, 98% of our pricing and rates are controlled by a government payer, either the state of Minnesota or the federal government. And that's simply because we serve such a high percentage of seniors that need that assistance from the state. DHS is currently updating the operating rates. I think the rates will be published this week. However, I think it's important for this committee to understand that these updated rates will reflect costs that we incurred in late 2020 and 2021. And for us, really when the inflation and the wage market started to be hyper-competitive was late 2021. So those costs that we've incurred since then, we'll probably see reimbursement in 2024. So declining occupancy levels obviously equals decreased revenues. Paired with the hyperinflation of goods, along with the significant labor wage increases that we have had to give to remain competitive, it really has put us in a position to work with our landlord on rent deferral. And if our current reimbursement system was working, we wouldn't be in that situation. So I ask that the members support House File 733, and if not, we'll be forced to continue to hold our occupancy down, keep those patients in the hospital while we continue to struggle to attract staff to our campus. The time to change the trajectory of our business and industry is now. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll now go to member discussions. Representative Baker.
thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mary, thanks for being here today. Your story was really remarkable, and just I've seen those and heard them in a number of them, and I think, Ms. Sirlo, your approach today to think differently, a little bit outside the box of bringing other people here is really important, and I know it was a group of you. I guess, Representative Edelson, thank you for this bill. You carry a lot of bills around here. And this is the number one bill in my mind that this has got to move in a way that others don't. This is a crisis, Mr. Chair, and I hope that we get creative around here about how we don't have to lay this one over, because it scares me that another 2 weeks go by. But if we sent a signal to our colleagues in the Senate, to other members in other committees, this is the burning bill that we must do everything we can to move forward. This, you know, the majority this year can move mountains. You've been showing us that you can do that. This is one that I want to make sure that we ask the question today in the committee, can we move this quicker than just laying it over for possible inclusion? And I ask that question with all respect, because this one is too important. And I heard immediate, urgent, now, and it's expensive. And I know we can't do it today because we don't have a fiscal note, Mr. Chair. But I'm hoping that we can make this one special, make this one set aside, do something so we can actually act with urgency. And I think that will send a great sound piece more than anything else we've done. And every week that goes by, these administrators out there, they are not sure what to do, because actually, quite frankly, They're late on their bills. They're late to pay their grocery bill. They're late on these bills. So this isn't like we can just deal with it in May or other times. We've done it. So I just ask that to the members, and if we can get creative, Mr. Chair, how can we possibly move this as fast as we can, having the authority we do here? That'd be more of a question for you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Representative. I think if you also look at House File 32 that I co-introduced with Chair Hoffman on the other side, and the discussion has been ongoing, and I think we're working through also with Representative Edelson's bill because it's more identical. It is a priority for us to look into what's happening in long-term care, what's happening in the other programs we're going to be hearing on Thursday, because there is a need out there. And we have to figure out how do we balance that need and to be able to get this bill quickly out of the committee to be able to bring to the floor. So the work is ongoing. We're hoping to do more work in the next few weeks on this. And even if we're waiting for the fiscal note, we also, some of this program are focused programs, as you're aware of. We're waiting for the February focus, which is another issue that we have to look into. And also, we don't have a target yet. We haven't been given, but we're negotiating with leadership in terms of how can we get this bill out before even the targets are issued. So it's an ongoing work, so I appreciate the question.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand that. This is a unique situation again. We have passed bills out of here without having a fiscal note before. We can pick it up in ways and means. There are ways to catch this and do it properly. We can vet it right. But there is no doubt, whatever the forecast is, Mr. Chair, whatever the targets are, we all know sitting here we have lots of money. And we don't get to say that every time. We really don't. This time we can. So there almost is no reason not to at least get it teed up as close as we can for the proper vetting, the proper committees. And again, I know, and you and Senator Hoffman are working on other good stuff too. This one, though, is different. And again, I just want to thank Representative Edelson for this. And I know there's other issues, other priorities. But, folks, this one and maybe House File 31. I'm not sure. I haven't looked at that one, too. 32, thank you. Thank you. But this is urgent. The place is burning, and our nursing homes need us today. And our administrators are loud and clear on that. And we're really doing everything we can. And my apologies. I have another appointment outside the door. I got to leave. But I just wanted to say that. So thanks for grabbing me first, Sean. Thanks.
While you're leaving, I think Jeff Fisher, you wanted to.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Noor. And I want to say thank you to the testifiers that we've had before us today. It's very important that we hear what's happening out there. And I also want to make sure that is one of the questions I had is we know that we've got a change coming up in the how we figure inflation in the future. And one of the things I'm wondering is as we make that adjustment that we've got coming off that we've had, if I remember right, off the House floor, if that goes through, how will that start helping this issue out here if we start figuring inflation in? The other thing is that, you know, we've heard a lot of things here that, you know, this is a dire situation. I also know that there's other things that are impacting some of the problems that came up today. Is when we hear about the backup in the hospitals, it's not just this area. It's also in the SUD area, the mental health area, where currently people who need services are being sent back home for the same reasons, because we don't have the staffing out there in the different situations. It's a crisis out there in other areas. It's not unusual in the SUD world, the mental health world, where people are committing suicide because they aren't able to get the help out there. So while I hear it's a crisis here, it's also a crisis in a number of other areas. And I want to make sure that we're making sure that those folks that are also at the hands where they're dying and not receiving the services, that we're making sure to not forget them in this entire process. So I want to make sure as we're going forward, we're covering these items. And I think the big part that we're hearing here is that, number one, we want to make sure everyone doing this work is being paid a great wage that they can raise a family on that has the benefits there. And that's regardless of what industry we're looking at. And the thing that comes back to me is we have this huge labor shortage out here. We need to start taking a harder look as how do we address that. I've had group homes come up to me saying, if I could have 250 people, I'd hire them today, and they aren't able to fire them. Find them at all at some of the rates that are at 20. They're offering $21 an hour. The people aren't out there. And I think what we need to do is we need to start thinking differently about our workforce out there. And what I'm getting at is one of the people approached me said, hey, I've run into some great workers.
They started, I had to let them go because they were not documented. We've got thousands of people at the border who are great workers that we're not having a, there's no way for them to get a legal way to come up here and work in this state or work in our country. And part of the problem is we need to start putting pressure on there because they're literally, we have literally tens of thousands of positions open in the healthcare field in providing care, and we've got thousands of people at the border who are competent people who are able to do this work, and we've never opened up to be able to find a way to help bring these people in. And I know care providers that would hire them as soon as they knew they were legal, but we've not created that system in this federal bureaucracy, and somehow we need to do that, because then that's what starts providing us with the supply of people who are willing to do this work, who are hard workers, who we could trust and we have trusted in our area. We need to be able to provide that process. I think that's part of the discussion that has to happen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Fisher, I couldn't agree more. I do know that the long-term care initiative, is that right? Long-term care initiative. They are working, because I had that exact same conversation in my office, is how are we working on the federal level to work on our immigration policies, whether it's a green card or whatever that may be, trying to make that, streamline that process. There absolutely is ongoing efforts there. But I would say with even just you look at the inflationary increase of what we see is reviewed every January, say that's 9%. If we're talking about $17 an hour, we're looking at $19 per hour. I mean, with that being said, it's still not enough. That's $38,000 a year. I mean, it's just not enough. And so while I agree we need to work on our increasing people in this country, I also think that we need to make sure that we're paying the current people well, so that they're not having to have two jobs, because that's what a lot of people do.
The next person, did you have a follow-up
question? Just real quick, because I know that one of the things that some folks have been working on is that there are a number of people who have applied for asylum, and once they apply for the asylum and their cases are filed, they're then able to start, within, I think it's 120 days, they are able to apply and get visas to be able to start working. One of the things that there's a group working on is trying to get additional resources into the volunteer legal aid societies out there to help provide that assistance to help move that process along. And that's one of the things I know there will be a bill coming out with that request that could help also help that side of the problem.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. Lead New Burnley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Edelson, for the bill. I'm wondering if we could hear from Ms. Thurlow or Ms. Cullen. I'm just curious to know how many seniors are currently living in long-term care facilities or assisted living.
If
do we know that?
Ms. Powell or Ms. They can come to the testify table.
I didn't mean to ask a trick question.
Do you think DHS sure. might let me to check and see if DHS knows?
I think it's 20.
Our data guy. Okay, the data. Mr. Chair, the data guy is coming up.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Todd Bergstrom. I work with Care Providers in Minnesota and am here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. Presently, there are about 25,000 nursing facility beds, and there are approximately 20,000 residents as of today. As far as assisted living, which we have a little bit less information on, there are about 60,000 units that are available, and our best guess is there's probably 50 to 55,000 people residing in those settings.
Mr. Bustam, do you know how many layaway beds in the nursing facility at this point?
Present, I don't know the exact number, Mr. Chair. We've, in the last 2 years, I think Ms. Cullen referred to it, we've seen about 2,400 since the beginning of the pandemic put on layaway or closed. As far as how many are currently on layaway, you'd have to ask the department. My guess is it's probably around maybe 3,000 or 4,000, but that's just a guess.
Thank you, Mr. need new friendly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. Do you know, I mean, so that would leave approximately 5,000 beds available. Are those actually available right now, or are they not filled due to staffing shortages? And do we have any idea how many seniors are currently waiting to get into a long-term care facility?
Mr. Bostrom.
Representative, Mr. Chair, yes, so there, that's on the back of the envelope. There are probably about 5,000 open beds. My sense from the data we've collected is that they are open because facilities are unable to staff them. As far as how many seniors are not receiving the services they need, I mean, you certainly have the hospital backup, which is one set of figures. When you get further into the community and where people are trying to place somebody from their home to an assisted living or to a nursing facility, it's frankly, we've not been, other than the anecdotal phone call where people call us and say, do you know of any place? We just can't collect it, if that makes sense.
Lee Newburn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. So perhaps maybe that 11,000 turned away in just a month from long-term care would, and that was from based on a survey. Is that, I think they said that was based on survey results.
Mr. Bush.
Yes, Representative, Mr. Chair, correct. It was back in October, and it was the survey was performed by us to our memberships, and it was how many referrals have you denied due to lack of staffing or inability to care for the person. And it came out to 11,000.
Excellent. Mr. Chair.
Lee Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if you are the one to answer this or if perhaps Ms. Thurlow or Ms. Cullen, but how many, we've heard different numbers, and I know that this has been in flux throughout the pandemic. I think we heard that there have been, it sounds like 18 closures, 15 prior and 3 last year of facilities. 2,200 beds, which is the equivalent of 40 nursing homes. That's alarming. I'm wondering where we stand right now with the risk of losing additional facilities. If we know how many facilities are sort of in that red zone right now.
Ms. Cook.
There's a pretty detailed, Mr. Chair, Representative, there is a pretty intensive process that a facility has to go through before it can close. And there's no public notification that can happen for a window of 60 days. What we know is what our members tell us. And what I know is I have had 2 presentations to community boards in the past week and a half where they're trying to make the decision about when they close and what pulls the trigger. So we know generally when the media knows and when legislators know, because there has to be a lot, the law is pretty intense on the privacy when it comes to that. We anticipate, however, that unless something is done soon, that there will be some additional closures. These are facilities that can't get lenders to continue guaranteeing payment. So the local bankers in your communities would probably have good answers to that question because they're the ones that are calling the question about the cash flow or, you know, the vendors that aren't being paid, like association dues.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in addition to the comments that my colleague have raised, I would offer that the long-term care imperative has been tracking the financial trajectory of our members throughout the pandemic. And we'd be certainly happy to follow up with more granular information. We do know that the 21-month delay is significant in reimbursement rates, is significantly contributing to the financial fragility of our sector. Quite frankly, our members are spending whatever money they have right now, which is not much, to try to increase caregiver wages. Caregiver wages have been increased over the last couple of years by double digits, but they're doing it by delaying payment of bills. They're doing it by draining reserves, by spending foundation money for our nonprofit members. And so to Ms. Cullen's point, we might not have an exact number on those that are on the brink of closure. Those are very private, confidential conversations until they're made public. But we do know from our survey that there really isn't a nursing home that is the model of financial health right now. And they very much are on the brink of collapse. We don't take that word lightly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for that information. What was most alarming to me is these two presentations just in the last week and a half. That tells me that it's an imminent problem. And thank you, Mr. Chair, for bringing this forward. And I know in our private conversations as well, this has been a significant issue, and I appreciate that. I'm hoping that what we could do today is to provide some flexibility in how we move forward with this bill. And I know we don't have a fiscal note yet, and I think that's really important to see a fiscal note before we do anything. But Mr. Chair, I would move to table the bill so that once we have that fiscal note and as we have more information over the next few weeks, we can take this bill back and take action on it when we need to, so that we could do so in a more timely fashion. I really appreciate that this is an area where there's a lot of bipartisan support. And again, Representative Edelson, I thank you for bringing the bill forward. But if we lay it over, we are limiting ourselves a little bit procedurally in how we move forward. And so I would move to table the bill now so that we could bring it back when we have that fiscal note and when we have that additional information so that we could take appropriate action at that time, whether it would be to lay it over or move it to the floor as we've done with other urgent bills.
Thank you, Lead New Brindley. I think that was our intent to lay over the bill so that we can pick it up once we have all the pertinent information. And also wanted the department to come and talk, you know, let us know what the whole impact of, because they'll have to produce the fiscal note anyway. So we'll have more conversation with the department. I wanted to ask nonpartisan staff if anybody wanted to add anything else. I know we said the bill will be laid over, you know, by the time we finish the discussion, so we'll pick it up as soon as we have more information.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I hope that we will do that in a timely manner. Again, you know, when we're hearing that there are these happening just in the last week and a half, this is more urgent certainly than waiting until May. And again, as we've passed other, you know, significant spending bills out of the committee without a target, without fiscal notes, I hope that we will consider and understand the urgency of this bill as well. We've got a lot of folks being served across the state and a lot of folks who are going to be in trouble. And not just the residents. This affects entire families. This affects communities and the folks who will be forced to give care if these facilities close down. Families are going to, you know, I mean, we talk about the workforce issue. That's only going to get worse if folks have to be pulled from their jobs to care for loved ones if these facilities shut down. So I hope that we will treat this with the urgency that it deserves. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I realize with the shortness of time that we have right now that my question is really technical in nature and just trying to understand the bill better. And I was particularly interested in that aspect of it that related to the residential providers and what was changing in terms of kind of their status for funding and things like that. But I think, you know, given you probably have other people on the list, maybe that's something I can learn, you know, in a different setting. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think Ms. Richmond is listening, and she'll be following up with you. You could have shared that information. It's the blue paper, so. For some of people in the audience who may not know, we do have our research done by the partisan staff, so they share more detailed information that's pertinent to the work we do. So they were going to share the Republican side of paperwork. So anyway, I have Zalesnica, Representative Zalesnica.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, Representative. I'm This is something I'm extremely passionate about. I'm not sure how many of you have been caregivers before, but if you've ever done 24-hour care and done it in your home for a night or a weekend, I can tell you it's much different to do it 365 days a year. There is no holiday. There is every weekend, and it is something that is urgent. And so I just am super excited to see something happen. My question is on the $25 rate. Mm-hmm. Is that tied to the CNA side for the licensed CNAs? I'm just wondering. Mm. In the nursing home side, elderly waiver, the elderly waiver side can be in the nursing homes, and but the elderly waiver side generally has PCAs and resident assistants. Some may or may not be CNAs. So I'm wondering if there's a step-down model goal for assisted living side, or is it just all based on $25? I just want to understand. Thanks.
Ms. Tunnell, if you will also state what is the current rate right now.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Zalesnikar. So the average wage for a CNA in nursing homes is about $17 an hour. It's fairly fairly comparable also for direct care workers in assisted living settings. And Representative Zalesnikar, to answer your question, and I'm certainly mindful of time, so if we need more details, I'm certainly happy to answer them. The mechanisms are a little bit different, you know, for the different reimbursement rates. For nursing homes, to try to reach the goal of a starting wage of $25 per hour, what we do is we do an immediate infusion of increasing resident days up by $52 a day. Because of the VBR system, it all funnels to staff at all positions, with the idea of putting that towards wages and benefits through direct care wages and benefits. On the elderly waiver side, the rate increases take effect, I believe, on January 1st, 2024. The elderly waiver rates travel with the client care plans, and so the rates and the various rate components are adjusted within those care plans. So it's a little bit more of a complicated explanation, but the goal is for that funding to also go to the direct care workers, with the goal of increasing wages in those home and community-based settings as well. I hope that gives you a little bit of a flavor. If we would like to get into more details, we certainly can.
We have 5 minutes and 12 questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I offer a clarification? You know, I made a motion to table the bill, and that is a different motion than laying it over for possible inclusion, and that does have to be addressed.
Oh, thank you. I didn't understand that when you were making the whether you wanted to make a motion or you were making.
Yeah, I did move to table the bill.
Then we need to take that motion prior to any other discussion. So, Lead New Burnley would like to move that House File 733 be tabled. That's the motion. Any discussion, members? It's not debatable. So that's the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
So I think the clarification is the motion that we're taking is to lay over the bill so that, you know, put it on the table so we can pick it up once we have all the pertinent information and proceed with the bill. So I don't know what's the major difference between the two in terms of how we can pick it up. Chair Fisher, I think we're in the middle of motion. So
right. To clarify the parliamentary procedure, this may go to partisan staff, might be able to help, but I think if we have a motion to lay it on, it takes a motion to take it off. If you lay it over yourself, we can pick it up at any time. And I'm looking for clarification if staff is able to clarify that.
Parliamentary inquiry. So,
yeah, my understanding is that with that, we could take it up the moment that we decide to, instead of having to give the 24-hour and schedule it and that type of thing. It has some some effects in the interaction with the rules about, you know, the notice and other aspects. Other than that, it's the committee versus the chair is my understanding.
CA.
I would just like to clarify, we can take up the bill, just like we did with House File 480 today. We are able to take the bill up again if it's laid over. We can, yes, we can take it up any time as long as it's
calendar. If it's calendar.
Yes, the difference between laying it on the table is a majority can vote to take it up.
It just gives us the flexibility to be able to bring up the bill when we have more.
Yeah, so we're discussing the motion, so I think we'll proceed with that. I don't have any objection. I don't know if any members. So all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
Nay.
See none. I think I've had the motion fails based on the nays that I'm hearing. So with that, the motion to table fails. We'll take a few questions and then we'll proceed with Representative. I have Representative Kwok.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a lot of the discussion has been about labor. And one of the things that we have fewer people working than before the pandemic, because we've also had thousands leave the state. We could pursue a variance and get worker visas for some sort of a pilot project for enterprise zones. It's file 507, which I'm very open to negotiating with, but there, that would be one route. The other thing is in the summary in sections 18 and 20, there are references to Twin Cities Metro average wage. I don't see anywhere that it has for the Rochester area, which has two things. One, a comparable cost of living, and two, a highly competitive job environment for this labor sector. So it's not just living, it's also the labor sector, if we're going to look at it more broadly. And the urgency, even if we passed it today and moved it, it would be, places would close before we could sign it and get it activated. And frankly, sometimes that also means people would die. I'm sorry I'm talking so much because I'm delaying the activity because it's that urgent.
I have Representative Franson, Representative O'Toole, and Representative Hicks. So we'll take three, 4 minutes, and then we'll conclude. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. You know, I was on this committee for 10 years, and then I got off the committee, and I considered it kind of a graduation, like I've done my time on the HHS. But the last 2 years, I've had numerous umpteen conversations, lost count how many conversations, with my nursing homes and long-term care on the situation that they are facing, which I am on this committee to advocate for my long-term care and nursing homes and those with disabilities. And that is my main reason for being back on this committee. And so I am hopeful, Representative Edelson and Chair Neuer, and to the majority party, that we can really do some bipartisanship here. I think this is an issue that there is consensus on both sides of the aisle that we want to get this done. And it's just, you know, when you talk to the individuals, I don't know how it is in the suburban areas, but in rural parts, we're very close-knit people. You go to the grocery store and you are running into the CEO of, let's say, Knute Nelson, or I might go to Zorba's, my son works there, and I might go there and I might run into some more people from the long-term care. And it's not when you want to get your groceries and you want to just go have a beer, you know, and you're talking shop, and it's hard, and they know that there's a major surplus, and they want funding, right?
In this particular place, I met on December 16th, Knute Nelson, Alexandria. In the care center itself, we have, this is December 16th now, so a month and a half ago, but 20 open positions. They might get one or two applications a month. They're offering bonuses for people just to pick up shifts so that there is that continuous care. The short staffing affects morale. Some feel that they are being rushed due to lack of staffing. And, you know, this particular place is licensed for 83 beds. They're struggling to maintain 63 beds because they can't find that staffing. And so I just implore us to work together to get this done. Like I said, we have bipartisan support on here. And I don't think pushing it off until the end of the budget is going to be beneficial. We know what happens at the end of the budget. Things tend to get pushed onto the side. They get forgotten, and it's we'll get to it next time. So, Representative Edelson, thank you for bringing this bill forward. And I really do hope that it is the intention of the majority party to be serious on this topic and not just carry a bill like we've been in the majority before, too. You know, you get somebody says, hey, can you carry this bill? And you're like, sure, and you champion the bill. But then when it gets down to the punchline, it's just kind of tossed aside. And this is way too important
Appreciate that, just be tossed aside. I know our time is running out, and I just wanted to give the other two members also to speak to this. So we'll have more conversation on this. Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. And I will be super brief, and I just want to say first, thank you. I agree, this is a really big issue. It's important that we fund seniors, but I want us to also remember that it's not just seniors. I want to bring us back and recenter us in that we're also talking about people with disabilities, sometimes in this bill, but also in many of the other bills that we have heard. So just so everybody knows, the percentage in change in home and community-based services for children under five is up by 0.4. The percent in home and community-based services for children 5 to 15 is up by 1.6. The percent in change for people 25 to 64 is up by 1.1. The change, however, in seniors is up by 16%. So it is a crisis because there are more of them that are needing support. But that doesn't mean that it is not equally important that we include everyone else. Individuals 65 to 85 make up 19.7% of the overall home and community-based services people. Everybody else is under 65. And so I just think it's really important that we remember that this is very important, but so are the others. And I don't want us to end up fighting over who's more important and forget that all of those caregivers and all of those people receiving care all matter.
Thank you, Representative Hicks, for your statement to the author of the bill, Representative Edelson, for your closing remarks.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a fun committee. I mean, this is great. Good discussion. I appreciate it. Representative Hicks, I don't want it to be about who's more important. We genuinely have a math problem. As Minnesotans, we do. And it's here at the Capitol, we do a lot of things that are bipartisan, and of course media doesn't cover it, but this will be one of them. However, we decide to do it. So, Mr. Chair, I'm glad that we're laying it over, because the fiscal note is going to be big, and we're going to have to talk about it. And Representative Franz, and nobody's carrying a bill to just, you know, say I carried it. I absolutely care about this. I have a lot of seniors in my district, and I think we all do, and that's why it is bipartisan. And Representative Quam, I would love to see your bill, so let's connect. And I guess one little quote before we leave is you know, I know that we all know that saying where how we treat our most vulnerable, it says a lot about who we are, right? We've all heard that. But how we take care of the workers that take care of our vulnerable is so critically important, and I think we can come together on that. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much for bringing this bill forward, Representative Edelson. So I renew my motion that House File 733 be laid over. This bill is laid over. Thank you so much. Members, no further action today in this committee. We are now adjourned.